find the defendants incredibly guilty. Hello and welcome to episode 158 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other satirical dictators as masterpieces. I am Nick, the failed producer of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
The failed artillery corporal, I guess.
of this podcast, and they are two entirely separate failed entities because we're going to discuss two entirely separate films with a linking theme. And the theme, in no way in relation to any current events that may be occurring in our dystopian real world.
Electric cars!
I wish that would be a happier topic. We are going to talk fascist dictators, more specifically, the fascist dictator of Germany from 1932-33 onwards. Adolf Hitler. But not just any Hitler. We are going to discuss satirical Hitlers as evinced by several films. This is going to be a dual episode. We're going to look at two satirical Hitlers in this episode and another two in the following episode. So stay tuned if satire and Hitler are your thing. This is getting into dangerous territory, so we'll just move on, shall we? Should we do them in chronological order, I feel?
Yeah.
That seems like the best way to do it.
So, yeah, I probably the first mainstream satire of Hitler,
barring it was a
shorter propaganda films and things.
The Great Dictator, filmed filmed and released while Hitler was still in power.
But obviously before the US had joined the war.
Yes, this is our first Charlie Chaplin film.
Mm.
And it was filmed in 39, released in 40.
Yeah.
And it's a, it's the story of Adenoid Heinkel, the dictator of, I forget the name of the fictional country.
It's that interesting tissue of deniability. If you read, say, Doc Savage stories from about this period, they will talk about a certain aggressive European nation. Well, never actually naming it, that the bad guy's agents are from.
Well, this is a similar thing. The party is I forget the name of the party now. It is the Double Cross Party. They wear the symbol of the Double Cross. Do you see what he did there? On the arm, in exactly the same styling as the fascist swastika. And it starts with it wasn't clear to me until some way through the film. It starts with a young corporal in the tail end of the Great War, the First World War, who I assumed was the young Adenoid Heinkel, but I think it's actually the other guy, because this is one of those hilarious films where someone looks identical to someone else. In this case, a young a Jewish shopkeeper.
Barber, specifically.
Barber, thank you. It looks identical to Adenoid Heinkel.
Yeah, and to start with, well, frankly, we get some Chaplin clowning. It's not so much my thing, but this is almost certainly, if people came to the cinema to see a Chaplin film, this is what they came for. This is the sort of thing he did very well. You know, the entire world is out to get me.
Yes, and it's classic kind of physical slapstick shtick, which I was always a Harold Lloyd guy, I guess, when I was younger. But it has, it's exactly that. It's just Chaplin's a little funny tramp guy, only this time he's in the, he's trying to load artillery weapons and falling over and getting into all sort of hijinks. Because he looks identical in either role, I'm still not entirely sure, but I think he's supposed to be the Jewish barber guy.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, the whole film so then we move back
The key thing is he runs into a guy who is a senior officer, even at this point, who must get a message back to headquarters immediately. and takes him along, basically because he's sufficiently wounded to be unable to fly right now.
Yes. This guy is very much of the old Bavarian officer stock.
I think, to be fair, one would say Prussian.
The Prussian kind of aristocrat.
The Bavarians are Catholics, you can't trust them.
Sorry, I did mean Prussian. I misspoke. The kind of Prussian aristocratic career military / count. He is actually a count, isn't he?
But also honourable, that's the key thing.
Honourable, kind of a von Stauffenberg kind of figure, but actually more Prussian and more aristocratic than that. And then we have comedic biplane japes. I mean, so how did you? So let's focus a little bit on, because a lot of the film is Chaplin's slapstick shtick. I mean, I've always felt this about Chaplin whenever I've watched it, that it is so clearly perfect. You know, he has done it and done it and done it until it's absolutely correct and perfect and like clockwork. But I find it a little, a bit like Kubrick, actually, a bit kind of passionless as a result. I don't know. It's just, I don't find it that funny.
And he does do the thing of making it look effortless.
Yes.
Which obviously is a technical quality, but it is a very impressive one.
Well, it's one of those where I find myself stepping backwards and thinking, the guy is incredible. He is an absolute master at this.
Mm.
But I personally,
including
sitting here,
timing as part of it.
Yes, exactly. But I, sitting here, don't actually find it all that funny or enjoyable to watch.
I think this may just be, we talk about things that have aged badly because they're, you know, blatantly fascist or whatever, but I think this has aged badly simply because there's been a lot of it and pretty much the things that can be done without permanently crippling yourself have been done.
Yes. Although, as I say, I always enjoyed Harold Lloyd as a kid and was often left a bit cold by Chaplin. I always enjoyed kind of the goofing. I haven't watched it for a long time, but like the Three Stooges, I kind of found it probably less perfect, but I found it funnier. And Laurel and Hardy, both, or at least Stan Laurel. Oliver Hardy was. Stan Laurel was something of a perfectionist, but I always found them funny. But maybe because they were in the talkies as well.
How about Buster Keaton? It's the other one that seems to me to be missing from your list.
Well, again, I suppose I'd lump him in with Charlie Chaplin. For some reason, it just leaves me a bit cold, Buster Keaton. But probably slightly prefer him to Chaplin. I never really enjoyed Chaplin's little tramp character.
Serious Chaplinologists have had long arguments about whether the barber here is supposed to be another iteration of the Little Tramp or not.
Yeah.
And from what I've seen of Chaplin, he's got a whole bunch of the same mannerisms. Some of them are slightly different, but you could say that about several of his other performances in that role. So I'm not sure it's a meaningful question, to be honest.
To all intents and purposes, he's playing a very similar, if not the same, character here, at least as the barber.
Insofar as he has a distinctive character anyway, he's a comic character much more than a... Yeah, I mean, he wants things. He wants to be off the streets or to get rich or whatever else. But he doesn't. The character per se doesn't really have a personality anyway, I think.
Except here, he's in a talkie. Was this Chaplin's first?
This was,
role?
Quite a lot, obviously, later than most people had gone over.
Yes. At least 10 or 15 years, wasn't it? Well, no,
at
longer
least
10, than that,
anyway.
Even 20. Yeah.
I mean, things are gradually growing over the 20s. I've seen previous Remnant of Memes about the artist where we talked about this in a bit more detail. But also, of course, by this time, he is the famous Charlie Chaplin. He is writer, director, star. Nobody really gets to tell him this isn't working. This could work two ways. I mean, I've seen some low-budget... what I would expect to be utter rubbish, which had somebody who had a creative vision and was going to stick to it. And that can go one of two ways. It's usually either very good or very bad. Very bad, it's still amusing. But I do think in general this is not an organisational strategy to take, even if, especially if you think you are a genius writer, director and star, you should have somebody else there who can say, Yeah, Nick, this isn't working, mate.
You know, don't worry, I've always got that. But yes, I take your point. And yes, it's here. I mean, I don't want to know how much we want to go into Chaplin himself. He was a complicated character in that his sexual politics were somewhat disturbing. But he clearly was anti-fascist and has had strong feelings. He wasn't Jewish, but a lot of people assumed he was.
Including the Nazis.
Yes.
He was one of their candidates for, you know, the hidden Jew among you pretending to be a normal person.
And he played up to that, to his credit. He did a lot of other things that weren't to his credit, including basically always managing marrying a teenager. Anyway, aside from the artist himself, we sort of follow the story, the dual story of Adenoid Heinkel. And does our barber ever get a name?
I don't think he ever does,
particularly. But this Jewish barber. And then we get this very weird, to me, tonally jarring mixture of basically Chaplin's Tramp and kind of Schindler's List, as we see the progression of the Third Reich and the oppression of the Nazis.
The SS is coming around to break your windows and drag you off to the camps, yeah.
Yeah, but then we'll have a little slapstick bit with the SS guard.
And the pretty girl next door drops something heavy on their heads.
Yeah.
Because that always ends well.
The theme of this episode is satirical Hitler, you know, in the sense that, is it better to laugh at these bastards than to try and fight them on their own ground? And I guess that's the point of pretty much all the films we're going to discuss in this little series. But here it's a strange mixture to me of this
now,
kind of serious stuff.
He did say in his autobiography in 1964 that he reckoned he couldn't have made it if he had actually known about the true extent of the concentration camps at the time. And this, I mean, that may be true. A lot of people, especially in the US, said we didn't know until after they had found out after the liberations.
Yes.
But the information was out there, and yes, it was possible to be willfully ignorant, but you did have to work at it. Because people were publishing a lot of books saying, I have been to Germany, I have actually seen, here is my first-hand account.
Well, even in this film, and the kind of snippets we see of how the Jewish people become oppressed, it's hard to see it without knowing that end point, but it's pretty clear. Even from the history we're presented in this film, even acknowledging no one knew about the Holocaust, it hadn't officially started at this point and didn't really ramp up till the end of the war. But even at this point, it's pretty clear to see the end point is not going to be good.
Mm.
And maybe not funny. And so
I suppose in one sense would make it transgressive. I mean, that's one of the things about transgressive comedy, that it's something that isn't funny, but is made to be funny anyway.
As opposed to black comedy, which is often not all that funny. but it doesn't, I don't know, there isn't a kind of the send-ups of the Nazi regime are not mocking, you know, the short-sightedness or the idiocy or, the send-ups are all ho-ho, the Hitler-alike has tried to sit on a chair and fallen over.
Or he's meeting the Mussolini analogue and he has the chairs of the Mussolini character sawn down so that he'll have to look up at him.
And that, Mussolini sits on the table. I suppose actually that is a bit closer to the kind of crappy power play that it, but even then it's played in a kind of a physical comedy slapstick form that doesn't feel particularly astute.
I wonder whether to what extent this is just what Chaplin does.
I think I have
seen some of his other films, but not recently. That's certainly the stuff that sticks with me.
I guess you use the tools in your arsenal, and that was what I mean. It's quite clear Chaplin thinks Hitler is a farty little smeghead who is to be laughed at, and also a kind of arrogant racist.
But also, and this is where I was quite surprised, somebody who doesn't really seem to care one way or the other about the Jews, except when not Goebbels tells him, oh, you know, we need a distraction, go and persecute the Jews. or that Jewish financier isn't lending us our money he promised for the war, so go and get the Jews.
Well, it's interesting that here the not Goebbels is kind of portrayed as the power behind the throne.
In the grand tradition of British actors playing the really meaty villain parts.
Yeah, he's kind of the Grand Vizier character, which is not that historically accurate, really. But I suppose it's not trying to be accurate. There are some nice points. There's the point where we have the adenoid is playing with the globe as kind of a bouncy ball.
That is definitely the sequence that I remembered from previous viewing, and it does work.
It works because the physicality suits that it's saying a lot of different things on different meanings. But most of the other kind of slapstick doesn't quite work for me.
Yeah,
because it hasn't got that resonance.
Yeah, the whole Goering has got a new invention that will win the war, and it doesn't work.
Yes, I think that's fundamentally. The problem, I mean, I won't go through the whole plot of the film, but basically there is hilarious mix-ups. One hilarious mix-up, which basically we have our little, our Jewish barber swapped with adenoid who gets sent off to a concentration camp.
But even that's only right at the end. I mean,
yeah.
All right, if you're going to do a double role, it's not required that you have one person impersonating the other at some point, but it's kind of what you expect.
You can see it coming, but this all leads up to this 3 minute long kind of polemic. Basically, after a bit of ho ho, he's fallen on the floor, let's get him another chair. Then the Jewish barber in the guise of adenoid Heinkel then basically speaks to the camera as Chaplin with a polemic about Nazis and fascism and freedom. Which, again, it's suddenly a jarring tonal shift. I found it a moving speech. My partner, who watched it at the same time, found it a bit kind of schmaltzy and heavy-handed. How did you feel?
I'm more with Shauna on this. It did seem heavy-handed, but then a lot of this film is heavy-handed. So it's in keeping. I mean, just remembering It's a Wonderful Life and the amount of schmaltz that people have had to put up with there, which is only a few years after this, after all. I can't help feeling that this may have been a thing that was reasonable at the time. Is he breaking character? I think he is. I mean, the barber has never been shown to be a great orator. I think this is probably mostly Chaplin addressing the audience.
That's how it feels. It's like, right, the film's over. Now I'm going to tell you what I think. Which I suppose is fine. Shorn from its historical context, as a piece, which is very hard to do, as a piece of entertainment, it doesn't really work for me. I'm not particularly excited by the slapstick. It is a long film. Did you find it long? Felt long.
Yeah, but again, I think, to be fair, this sort of physical comedy heavy approach, and that there is lots of it on in both the roles, is something that people were into at the time, and to me that's a format that works better in a short, like, you know, your Keystone Cops or your Bugs Bunny or whatever. And not necessarily that it should be modern, but my approach to this is it's great for a few minutes, 10, 15 minutes at most, and then I want to break and do something else.
Yeah, yes, I absolutely agree. I think that's why it felt like it's like watching kind of, you know, a Looney Tunes cartoon that goes on for a long, long time. It is. It's fine for a bit. And I'm not all that into the Chaplin. I fully acknowledge he was a physical genius and a master of his art, but it doesn't work for me. And that may be from my historical perspective.
And yet, the thing that people disliked at the time was not all the physical comedy, it was the preachy bit at the end.
Well, I can see it's just tacked on. And it does seem prescient. I don't know, is it prescient when war is raging in Europe already when you're filming this? Maybe not. But it was saying things, I guess, to the American public that Chaplin felt they needed to hear. And so as a piece of propaganda We're not fans of propaganda on any side.
It undermines to some extent your classic war propaganda, because, yeah, every, you know, since the invention of the printing press, every side on a war says the other sides are not really human, you know, they're mindless, they're fanatically devoted to the Pope, whatever.
Yes.
And the thing he's saying here, and I suspect this may be one of the reasons at least that it wasn't popular, is that no, you know, ordinary Germans are still ordinary Germans. It's just these guys in charge.
Yes, yeah, that's... yes, that's interesting. We'll maybe come back to that in some of the other films as well. I was surprised how date, and this is because of Chaplin, but, you know, this is a film that is a few years away from Casablanca, from It's a Wonderful Life.
Mm.
It feels like a much, much older film to me, much less sophisticated as well. Not physically, not cinematographically, but in terms of plot and story, it just felt very of the 20s.
Yeah, and there's one thing that you certainly wouldn't be able to do post... part of the thing is, of course, post-war, there have been lots and lots and lots of studies made of Hitler, of the high-ranking Nazis. We know a lot more than the audience would have known then.
Yes.
But the thing I find particularly interesting is this idea of him as the keystone. You know, the moment he is replaced by the barber, well, that's it. He can defuse the war.
Mm.
A bit I found out while doing research for the Second World War campaign I ran for several years was that in the early days of the war, there were a lot of British, particularly, plans to assassinate Hitler by various sneaky means.
Mm.
But by about 1941-42, they had worked out that this guy is... he's not actually that competent.
Yeah, and they're better off with him in charge.
And the more he interferes, and he is increasingly wanting to be in charge of everything, and the more he does that, the worse the German system works. If we kill him, he will be replaced by somebody else who won't be any more ready to make peace, because the moment anybody tries to make peace, he will be assassinated by his underlings, but may be more competent.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, and there's there are a number of science fiction stories along those lines of time travelers assassinating Hitler and finding out actually they ended up with someone even worse. Yeah.
Now, the other person I think possibly worth mentioning is Paulette Goddard, as said, beautiful girl next door.
Yes.
She was only 19 years younger than Chaplin, and she was in her
20s. Not bad by his standards.
She was 28 when they married.
Well, that's definitely not bad by his standards.
This is about halfway through their marriage that this was made. But I've got to say, her character is a bit of a babbling idiot. I mean, she starts off, you know, I want peace and I want everybody to live together and so on. And then she just goes on with it. And even the barber on screen is getting a bit fed up with this, oh, wouldn't it be nice if...
I haven't mentioned it because she doesn't, she doesn't really have much of a character, or not what you would call a consistent character. But then no one does. They're all caricatures.
Mm. Who's playing him? I mean, I feel that this should be a terribly well-known actor. Is it Morris Moscovich, maybe? Mr. Yekel?
I think it's Carter De Haven as the Bacterian, but is that right? No. Perhaps we should.
I mean, part of the problem is nobody's getting a name here, so.
Well, this is it. They're interchanged. We have the villainous Goebbels alike. We have the Mussolini alike. We have the Hitler alike.
Oh, it is Morris Moscovich.
Okay.
So he mostly worked in Yiddish theatre. He did films only in the last few years of his life, and this, in fact, was the last film he made. But he's bringing a frankly unexpected dignity, which doesn't yes. fit terribly well in this film, but my goodness, that's actually quite a good performance.
Yes, that's fair to say. I mean, overall, The Great Dictator, for me, I understand why it's considered a masterpiece. Because it did something not new, but new to the American audience, perhaps. And it was done by a master of it, of the craft at the time. It feels to me more like a historical oddity, an interesting academic study in something, but frankly, as a piece of enjoyment, piece of art, it didn't work for me, especially.
Yeah, and it had its moments, but you know, I'm sure that the clip with the globe is on YouTube somewhere.
Yeah, and that's worth seeing.
Frankly, that's the bit I would probably rewatch rather than the whole thing.
Yes, I would not be in a hurry to rewatch this. Okay, so shall we move on?
27 years, yeah.
Is it our first Mel Brooks film?
No, we talked about him a bit in when we were talking about Robin Hood.
We did briefly mention Robin Hood, Men in Tights. But this is Mel Brooks' first feature film, I believe. 1967, The Producers. And this is the story of Max Bialystock, an extremely sleazy a Broadway producer who earns his money by sleeping his way through a horde of elderly ladies who then fund his plays for him. And Leo Bloom.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be fair to call him a gigolo at this point.
He is. He's got a specific audience, but he is a gigolo. But he his delightful habit is getting them to write out checks to the, often calling the play cash or just saying, oh, just write it out to cash. It reminds me of Alan Bastard in The New Statesman. But this preceded that. And Leo Bloom, the kind of very nervous, anxiety-ridden accountant who is sent to check his books. So this is our... Have we talked about Gene Wilder before? But this might be our first Gene Wilder film.
Gene Wilder we have seen in Bonnie and Clyde.
Oh, of course, yeah. That may have been his first
very early
film.
Episodes.
And Zero Mostel, who we haven't really talked about before, but they are a comedy pairing.
Well, I have a strange relationship a strange relationship with Zero Mostel. And when I see his name in the credits, I think, yeah, this is good. This guy's good at what he does. And then when I see him in a role, he's often very basic, very simplistic comedy, but he just does it so very well. He's a joy to watch.
Yes, I absolutely agree with every word you just said. Which doesn't make for good audio, but
I had a weird feeling watching this though, because it's like watching Borscht Belt comedy. You know, I am not Jewish. I don't have any Jewish ancestry, as far as I know. And when I see this sort of thing, which is taking off the stereotyped Jewish image of themselves, I think, well, you know. Obviously, I couldn't tell those jokes, but more to the point, these guys are telling the jokes about themselves to each other, and I feel like a bit of a voyeur.
It does feel a bit of a kind of kind of a niche comedy, or like almost like a an in jokes within a family, in this case the Jewish family, and the way they talk about each other. But you're right, it is like. It's partially that, and partially it's a certain style, which may be that kind of style, which is very overacted, very theatrical, and extremely shouty.
These are, or at least Max is, a theatrical guy. So yes. one could argue that it's actually in character for him to be like that.
Yeah, less so, I think, Gene Wilder.
He is less so. He is very much on edge. He's the classic nervous accountant type.
Yeah, it's just there's a lot of... Shauna, again, she watched this with me. Unfortunately, she's not here tonight. She's not feeling that well. But she summed up the comedy quite well as... It's just a lot of loud things one after the other, and they're funny in and of themselves, but I guess we're more used to comedy sort of building upon itself to a sort of crescendo of humour rather than this staccato.
Let's consider Airplane.
Well, Airplane
is... previous episode, which was derided at the time because it was just a constant stream of jokes.
Yes.
But...
Well, Mel Brooks was the originator, I guess, on the screen of this kind of... Because, again, he went, this is the one that has more of a narrative, but then we went on to, you know, Blazing Saddles, and which are all... were all that kind of humour, but a bit more zany. And then Airplane had the genius idea of doing all that, but playing it completely straight.
And also hanging it round an existing dramatic structure. But, yeah, you know, go and listen to that episode for more on that.
But, yeah, it... Yes, it's quite clear. It's that kind of, yeah, here's a joke, here's a joke, here's a joke. We're not going to build on anything previously. It's just, I mean, it works because both Gene Wilder is just funny, I find, to watch. And Zero Mostel, yeah, as you say, is also funny to watch. So it works, but it took me some getting used to of this. It's different to the later Mel Brooks in that it just is very clashy and shouty, and it didn't leave me cold in the way that the Chaplin stuff does. But it takes, so I think you saying eavesdropping feels it, you're kind of aware it's funny and it is doing, but you feel a little uncomfortable or something. Yeah, maybe that's a good way of putting it.
But also, and I don't know to what extent this is related to it or just related to it being 1967, but frankly, women do not come off well here at all. You know, teehee, older women can like to think they're loved.
And the younger woman is...
This is funny. The young woman is an object.
Nothing more. Yeah. Sadly, I completely agree. She is given more to do, and I will touch briefly on the remake. From some years later, but the core of the story,
and the reason why it's on this episode
is because Max Leo comments in passing, you could actually make more money from a flop than a success, because if you get everyone you meet to fund you and then tell all of them, you know what, I'll give you 100% of all the profits, but the play never makes any profits at all, then you can keep all the funding, spend a tiny amount on the play, and keep all the rest for yourself.
Mm-hmm. So, after a token argument, that's what they do.
And they dig out Springtime for Hitler, which is the cheery story of a young Adolf, I've forgotten the subtitle now, but it's a young Adolf Hitler and the rise of Germany, but done as a kind of a musical
gay romp
comedy
with Adolf at Everett Berchtesgaden.
that's a funny idea straight away. And Mel Brooks's idea here is at this point, aside from The Great Dictator, he felt no one had mocked the Nazis for their many ridiculous features. And so here we have this Nazi writer trying to say how great Hitler was, and doing it in musical theatre. Except I don't think he writes it as a musical, does he? I think they add in the music later.
Yeah, so first of all, they need to get the rights from the author, who is... Yeah, okay, so he is the what later becomes a standard stock character of the fanatical ex-Nazi. I mean, yeah. When is Dr. Strangelove anyway?
But yes, they end up leaving that meeting wearing Nazi armbands. And, you know, the idea of...
1964, so it's 3 years before this.
Oh, well, okay. But the, yeah, okay. Oh, that's interesting, actually. The idea, I mean, it is funny. It's so far and ridiculous that the idea of these two Jewish men are so happy to debase themselves that they're very happy to wear kind of swastikas on. Not very happy. They are uncomfortable about it.
But also, you know, it's 20 years later and that's history now.
Yes, exactly. They, you know, that happened to someone else and didn't happen to them. And sure, they probably knew people. But right now they need money, damn it. And so they're just stereotypical shysters, I guess. Or at least Max is. Leo just gets dragged along for the ride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a different film could make a really quite compelling psychological study of how Leo gradually gets corrupted. But yeah, this is not that film. It's not trying to do that.
No. Well, it's interesting. Again, I'll talk about it later. But they do, in the remake, 2005 remake, they do, it's interesting that they do try and tack on some character building. There we have Matthew Broderick in, as Leo, and Nathan Lane as Max. And they do, they seed, like, earlier in the play, earlier in the play, because this is actually a musical play that was then adapted. So it was a film, then it became a musical, then that musical was adapted again for screen. And it's interesting.
All of them with Mel Brooks involved. I think on the remake, he was not direct, but he was a producer, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, but it's interesting that one, they give Uma Thurman, who is the token female, the young female, they give her a lot more to do in the remake. Mm-hmm. And they seed that why Leo is unhappy at the accounting firm. And so consequently, the narrative, to my modern eyes, works a bit better in the remake, but it's fine. So we get this ridiculous, play. He gets the worst possible director, who is, again, very stereotypical. It feels a bit like an in-joke, doesn't it? The stereotypical, extremely camp director with his extremely camp assistant boyfriend.
Very fine facial hair, though.
It's lovely. It's a very distinctive look. To produce it, and then he gets the worst possible Nazi, which in this the worst possible Hitler, which in this version is the kind of a, what do you call him, like a beatnik kind of...
It's a bit late for beatniks, but definitely that style, and possibly a bit early for hippies.
Somewhere between a hippie and the Fonz, I guess, in a way. It's kind of very laid-back, cool, hey, man, I'm going to invade Poland, man, kind of character.
Also, where's my LSD?
yes. So it's got some quite funny sequences. I mean, for me, that of course, what happens ultimately is, as you might predict, or at least know, because this is quite a famous storyline, it's actually a massive success and everyone loves it.
Having hated the introductory number.
Yes.
So,
Hitler turns up.
But once they start saying what a parody has been made of it, this becomes, okay, we love it, we will give it great reviews and all the rest of it.
Which leads to Max and Leo then being imprisoned and trying to do the same thing again in prison. I mean...
Clearly they are being reformed by their experience.
For me, I mean, the standout in the film, and really, to me, is... in a way, it's so much better and more enjoyable than the rest of the film, is the actual opening. The Springtime for Hitler, I just think, is incredible. I love the music and the lyrics and just the sheer, the women wearing like churns and bagels. And it's just
generic
so
German stuff.
Yes, it's like, which is through every generic German thing we could. And it works for me because it's so crass and tacky and awful, but it's supposed to be, and that's the whole point of the thing. And you can see it work, and just the expression of the audience. I thought that was great. The rest of the film, for me, is semi-funny. I mean, it's not, I'm not sure.
The film was a success. This clearly worked for at least some of the audiences at the time.
Yes. How did it work for you? Am I being a grumpy git?
Well, as I already said, I'm getting this feeling that this humour is being addressed to the guy sitting next to me rather than to me.
Right.
And I'm in here by accident or something. I mean, maybe that style, I think this probably drifts in somewhat to the Borscht Belt style of comedy.
Yes.
Which is more in the 70s, I guess. But yeah, maybe it had not seemed so completely worn out and overblown in 1967. To me, this is, I have seen these shticks, I've seen these ideas done a lot before.
And
this doesn't really bring anything I haven't seen before, which is, you know, not the film's fault. Maybe it was more unusual then. But
yes,
it feels like, oh, that tired old stuff.
Yeah, this is almost the stuff that from which Airplane was a bit of a breath of fresh air, because that was done in a different... to me, it has a zany feeling, and it might be that Britishness doesn't do zany quite so well. It's just...
Well, I mean, Monty Python. There is a reason. I mean, Monty Python was taken up wholesale by the US, which is one of the reasons there are so many people who will still repetitively quote it today.
Because Monty Python, of course, if you go back and watch it nowadays, it's actually not that great.
But because it was so different from anything that was being done at the time, particularly on television.
Mm. Yeah. So as a comedy, it worked just because it pushes the outrage so far. And if you think of the time he was doing it and how much it annoyed lots of people, but it is a bit, it has got that slight feeling of, like South Park or, the Book of Mormon, that this is actually dressed up as the most outrageous thing ever. But actually, it's a fairly conventional story. It's just that the things in it are outrageous. It's not truly shocking.
Mm.
Because that kind of thing is more like the American New Wave, which this is a contemporary of, you know, where it just throws all narrative aside and narrative conventions aside. It's not really doing that. It's just taking, you know, where the MacGuffin would normally be something of a gentle comedy, here it's Hitler dancing around saying, winter for Poland and France, and,
That'd be stupid, be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party, yeah.
Exactly. They use Mel Brooks' line in the remake again, which is nice. I mean, I like the producers. The remake does improve in a number of... It's a pure musical, the remake, so your mood may vary on that. But it does explain... I don't want to get too deep into the plot because it doesn't matter. But one confusing thing is... the play is as it was rehearsed and written, the play... is kind of funny. You would have thought someone at some point would say, actually, this beatnik Hitler guy is actually quite funny. People are laughing. And at which point he would be sacked and replaced by someone who wasn't. In the remake, what happens is the Hitler they have is, breaks his leg because it's going to be the writer, the actual Nazi. Mm-hmm. He breaks his leg on the opening night, which is a joke because it's like break a leg, and he does break his leg. And he's replaced by the extremely camp director.
Mm-hmm.
And that works better for me. A very camp Hitler works better for me than a 60s beatnik kind of Fonz, because there is something quite camp about Nazis anyway. And so being extremely camp...
all that rugged masculinity and black leather, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That works better for me. And so, again, the opening number of Springtime for Hitler, I think is even better in the remake, but Matthew Broderick is no match for Gene Wilder. I'm sorry to tell you, Matthew.
I suspect he would agree, frankly.
As far as a satire goes, how do you think it works? A satire of Hitler?
Well, I mean, we've already been talking about things being heavy-handed, and oh boy, this is heavy-handed.
But deliberately so.
Yeah. I think because it is deliberate, but I don't know. I mean, I assume that Great Dictator was also deliberately heavy-handed.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, yeah, fair enough.
It's not trying to be subtle because neither of them is really trying to address the actual historical Hitler and the ways in which he was messed up.
Yes,
they just take here is the image, and with that in mind, yeah, there we go.
Yes.
So, and where it's satirising actual Nazism, I think it's more with is it Fritz? It's some obvious name of that sort.
The writer of the play. Yes. Yeah.
I think that's much more. Franz Liebknecht. I think that's much more where it's trying to satirise it, and frankly, it's an easy target at this point. It's not controversial that Nazis are bad and silly.
I think as a film, it works quite well. But you, as a satire of Nazism, I'm not sure it even really is much of it. I mean, you could. It's funny because Mel Brooks is Jewish in the recent history and the whole. But you could literally have replaced the whole Hitler with something equally outrageous, and it would still have worked as a film.
Yeah, I mean, Stalin seizing power could have worked just as well.
Yeah,
or you'd need an audience who knew slightly something about it, obviously. But
Or some, you know, I don't know, I take a random example, some orange madman taking over the reins of the largest democracy in the West. Something like that. But, it, you know, it could have worked. I'm not sure you literally don't need it to be a satire of Hitler for the film, for the narrative to work. And so as such, I admire its bravery, but I'm not sure really what it's saying about Nazism other than, weren't they a bit ridiculous? Isn't it time to sort of laugh at them?
Which
is a good thing. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that. Okay, have we more to say about producers?
I mean, both of these are doing the thing they do and doing it on a technically competent level, but they don't move my soul. But that's me.
I think
comments on Black Link at heart, etc.
I enjoy The Producers a lot. I'm very glad that Springtime Fiddler exists, as a thing. For me, it's not a masterpiece because it's not actually super subversive or original or much imitated. So it doesn't quite work for me as a masterpiece.
Yeah. But both good in their way. I think it much more likely that I'll watch The Producers again than that I'll watch The Great Dictator again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But as comments on Nazism, they're fairly blunt, not that original, but then they were some time ago.
Yeah.
Well, we'll retire this episode of Ribbon of Memes and come back with some more thoughts on other satirical Hitlers in a few weeks. Cheerio. Oh, oh,